This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Moorish. Orthodox. Radio. Crusade. Anarchism for the global city. Radical environmentalism for the concrete jungle. Esoteric explorations of the secret history of rebel culture. The Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Every Tuesday at midnight after the news, only on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. Be there.
Welcome to the spectacle. All that appears is good. All that is good appears.
You decide on the right answers.
Age and the global society. These forces have nearly destroyed our nation. We have been touched by tragedy.
The spectacle is not a collection of images, but rather a social relationship mediated by images. Wherever representation takes on an independent existence, the spectacle reestablishes its role. Spectators are linked only by a one-way relationship to the very center that maintains their isolation from one another. The spectator feels at home nowhere, for the spectacle is everywhere.
That is good. Up to you. Welcome into the spectacle. All that appears is good. All that is good appears.
Welcome to the spectacle, huh? Okay, well, this is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade, so welcome to this, which is hopefully a deviation from or exception to the spectacle. We're in the studio tonight with some guests, including Chris Carlson, the author of Nowtopia, How Pirate Programmers, Outlaw Bicyclists, and Vacant Lot Gardeners Are Inventing the Future Today. Welcome aboard, Chris.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
And Eric Goodman, who is one of the co-producers of a sort of a multimedia work entitled Thus Spoke the Spectacle. The title itself referencing both Nietzsche and De Bord.
There you go.
There you go. So, Eric, can you tell us a little something about Thus Spoke the Spectacle?
Well, we basically borrow the term from French radical Guy Debord and his book, Society of the Spectacle. The song we just heard is from our video, Separation Perfected, which is named after the first chapter of that book, where Debord defines the spectacle in various ways. For example, as the world of illusion, where all attention and consciousness converge, or as a social relationship mediated by images and so on. But to us,
I take it the quotes which were sampled were from Society of the Spectacle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those were from the first chapter, right?
Which he wrote in what, 1960?
68. And he gives a whole bunch of definitions in that chapter. I mean, 10, 15, a whole, you know, there's a lot of people are always asking, what is the spectacle? And so there's a whole bunch of, he gives a lot of answers. To us, it basically boils down to the corporate-controlled, media-saturated technological environment that has become our world. It's basically the voice of power in our times and the mechanism through which that power, that voice is projected.
And where have you thus far performed Thus Spoke the Spectacle?
Colleges. We performed at NYU and Rockland Community College and a bunch of places, some high schools were in Massachusetts. Performed in New Hampshire and recently in Pennsylvania, a place mm-hmm. called Eckhouse Gallery. It's a student-run art gallery attached to the university. And going out there in a couple of weeks out to California to perform for a media convention, the Media Ecology Association.
Media Ecology?
Yes.
Hmm. What does that mean exactly?
Well, it's basically the idea of media as environment. It's based on the work of people like Neil Postman and Marshall McLuhan and Louis Mumford and Jacques Ellul, fellow Frenchmen of Debord. So I see there's a synergy between the thought there. He's the guy who wrote Technological Society.
Yes. Okay. So your work, Thus Spoke the Spectacle, is merging music and images.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah. Well, we perform as a rock band with basically the spectacle itself as our lead vocalist, so to speak, represented by images and sound bites projected from a video screen in the middle of the stage, while my drummer, Mike Stevens, and I are off to the sides, basically providing the soundtrack for these stories.
And you're
stories.
Playing guitar?
I do guitar and also the spoken word vocals, here and there. But our main, basic premise is that we deconstruct and reconfigure these elements of the mainstream media in order for the spectacle to speak for itself, hence the title, Thus Spoke the Spectacle.
And who else were you sampling in that cut that we opened with? Was that, did I hear some of our fearless leader, George Bush, back there?
There was a Clinton quote, actually. Yeah. We've got some Bush in other places. Yeah. We've got a whole, when we get to WMD Blues, we play that later, there's a whole bunch of GW in there. But that was Clinton. There was the first voice is actually Noam Chomsky. Right answers are what you decide are the right answers. We thought it was good to open the show with something positive.
Mm. Okay, and you're going to be performing this a week from tonight.
Correct. Over at the Living Theater?
Right, as a part of the Libertarian Book Club monthly anarchist forum.
That's right.
So that's going to be next Tuesday, June 10th at 7 p.m.
at the Living Theater, which is at 21 Clinton Street on the Lower East Side, just south of Houston. This is, once again, part of our... long-time listeners will know that we've sort of been going through a long-term identity crisis. We started calling ourselves the Libertarian Book Club back long before I was born, actually, in the 1940s, back when the word libertarian had not been co-opted by the free market right. But now we sort of we're split between those who feel that we should militantly hang on to this word and others who feel that the battle is lost and that it's been co-opted. So now we're the group is still called the Libertarian Book Club, but the event is now called the Anarchist Forum as opposed to the Libertarian Book Club Forum. So we do this every month at the Living Theater, and a big shout out and thanks to the Living Theater for hosting us. It feels like we've really found a home, and because we've sort of been adrift for several years, but we're getting back in the swing of things, and this seems like it's going to be a an ambitious performance. So we'll have the chance to announce it again, but once again, just mark your calendar in red right now. 1 week from tonight, June 10th, 7 p.m. at 21 Clinton Street on the Lower East Side at the Living Theater for Thus Spoke the Spectacle. With do you actually call the group Thus Spoke the Spectacle as well?
That's a good question, Bill. We don't really know what to call ourselves. We haven't really decided. People just start calling us The Spectacle or The Spectacle Guys or whatever. The show has always been Thus Spoke the Spectacle. It's over 10 years, and so I've performed it solo. I've performed it with bands. Right now it's a duo, me and a drummer, but we've yet to codify that exactly.
I got a name for you. Call yourselves The Representations.
Sounds good. I'll run that by the powers that be.
And Chris Carlson, author of Nowtopia, How Pirate Programmers, Outlaw Bicyclists, and Vacant Lot Gardeners Are Inventing the Future Today. Much of which is provocative right in that title. Hot off the presses from AK Press out in San Francisco, which is also where you're from.
Mm-hmm.
And you just got back from Italy.
Italia, yeah.
Lucky you.
Yeah, I feel lucky. I feel a little groggy, too, so everybody can forgive me if I sound a little slower than usual, but perhaps that's good for the radio to slow down a little bit.
And when were you on Critical Mass in Rome?
Well, actually, for three straight days. They have this huge celebration every year now at the end of May, and they have a regular monthly Critical Mass like most cities of the civilized world now do. So that's on the last Friday of the month, typically, although not every city has it on that particular time. And then on the Saturday, they call it Chiamona, which is Italian for the big critical mass. And that one was really huge with a ton of international.
I'm sorry, that's Italian for the big critical mass.
Right. CM and then CM
in
Italian, and then Chiamona means
gotcha.
A big CM.
Gotcha, right.
So sort of odd, but you get used to it over there. Mm. And then after that, so then there's another huge ride. It was much larger there on the Saturday ride all through Rome, up and down and through all the old streets. We actually took the freeways for the first time this past Saturday, and coincidentally, so did the ride in Toronto on Friday. Took the freeways through Toronto. So apparently there's a zeitgeist out there for critical mass rise to seize freeways right at this moment.
Were there any arrests?
Nope, not at all. In fact, it was remarkable to me how much chaos was caused and how little violence ensued, considering I know what it would have been like in San Francisco, so and certainly here in Manhattan.
Oh, to say the least.
Yeah, Manhattan's sort of the trendsetter for police violence these days in many respects. But then the final day of the critical mass experience, if you will, in Rome over this long weekend was to go al mare, to the beach. And so it's a 25-kilometer ride straight down south of the city to the sea. And we all made that ride together. About 1,200 bicycles are still in the game by then. And came to the beach and had a lovely afternoon on the beach. And a bunch of us went home on the train after that. But many people camped out overnight. And about several hundred were surprisingly held hostage by the police on their return to Rome on Monday.
Held
yesterday.
Hostage?
Yeah, they came into the main station where you end on the return, and it's the same day as an Italian National Day, and they have they have this huge military parade going on in the center of the city, and so without explaining to the cyclists why, they said you can't leave the station, and kept them there for about an hour and a half, several hundred of them. So a minor scandal ensuing in Rome right now over that.
Got some media play. And,
yeah.
Well, good. Glad to hear it.
Quite entirely illegal.
How long a ride is it to the beach? I mean, Rome isn't right on the sea.
No, it's 25 kilometers, so, you know, about 17, 18 miles, something like that. Pretty serious. But, you know, good. It's pretty easy. It's an easy ride, but it's hot there, so you're dealing with some serious temperature issues.
So this went on for 3 days.
Yep. Every day. Friday started at 6. Saturday starts at 4, and then Sunday was at 11 in the morning, but we gathered. We didn't really leave till about 12:30. And each night ends in big parties and picnics and celebrations.
Wow.
It's really fun. I highly recommend everybody get your bike or go to Rome and rent a bike and borrow a bike and try it out. It's an awesome experience. And the Romans are
This is just once a year that they...
Well, they have a, you know, like I say, they do have a monthly critical mass. You can join anytime you like. But if you want this particularly wild weekend experience, then you have to go at the end of May. And this was their 5th annual one, so you can be pretty sure it'll go on happening. They, you know, it's been bigger and bigger every time. I think the one on Saturday was probably somewhere between 4,000 and 5,000 cyclists.
Wow.
And yeah, it's serious. I mean, it's...
From all over Europe?
Yeah, people of all over Europe. I mean, a few of us Americanos were there, but mostly it was people from other parts of Europe, mostly people from Italy. All over Italy show up for that, too. There's 23 cities in Italy that have their own critical masses. So people came in from all over the country, and then a fair number of people from France and Spain, and a few people from the Czech Republic, some Germans, some Austrians, some Swiss. So it was really an awesome experience, because I met so many people and had so many fantastic conversations. So I was really quite thrilled.
In what languages?
English, of course, the lingua franca of the world. You know, I'm a dumb American. I'm one of those dumb monolingual Americans who get overseas and you just hope people are kind enough to speak to you in your language, and they mostly are.
Right. Well, we made history here at New York Critical Mass last Friday as well. Actually, I don't know if you heard about it.
No, what happened?
Well, Al Sharpton showed up, and he actually rode.
Oh, my God.
If you can believe that.
No, it's hard to picture.
Well, it happened.
Well,
and
must have been working out.
It was actually on the subject of police violence, it was kind of a convergence of the Critical Mass movement and the movement for justice for Sean Bell.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we've had critical mass to save the community gardens, and we've had critical mass to save our community centers, some of which have been evicted and some of which we've successfully fought to save, particularly here. I shouldn't say here on the Lower East Side, but on the Lower East Side, because we're actually down on Wall Street at the moment. But this was critical mass for Sean Bell, and Sean Bell's family was there, his survivors, his brother and his fiance, and Al Sharpton was kind of the star of the show.
Amazing.
He actually rode.
And what did the police do this time? Just hands off?
You know, I'm not entirely sure on how many arrests there were, but there were some arrests, without a doubt.
For the usual non-existing crime of riding in a group?
Yes, precisely. Mm-hmm. Yes. And for the rather selectively enforced crime of running red lights and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the other issue which was being addressed was the whole sort of quasi-privatization of Union Square Park, which is where Critical Mass always meets here in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got this, you know, we always used to meet up at the north end of Union Square Park, which a lot of listeners will know is now, there's very little access up there. It's mostly behind chicken wire because they're getting ready to do this major renovation there, which is going to mean expanding 17th Street and actually eating a chunk of the park and turning it into an extra lane for 17th Street, and also expanding the commercial establishment at the north end of the park and turning it into a sort of an upscale eatery, which is not good, creeping privatization of public space. So my one announcement, just to get it out of the way, is that June 5th, which is going to be is that going to be Friday or Thursday,
That's
June 5th?
Thursday.
It's Thursday. That's what I thought. Thursday, June 5th, 5 p.m. at the northwest corner of Union Square. There's going to be a rally to declare Union Square not for sale. Bloomberg and his cronies have a vision of New York City where parks are for profit. People are squeezed out of public spaces and free assembly is made impossible. Their plans to privatize Union Square were approved through a rigged process, approved, quote-unquote, through a rigged process that steamrolled widespread opposition. But the privatizers have overreached. They tried to sidestep the law, and a judge said, wait a second, now it is our turn to blow the lid off this scam and push back the privatizers. So we'll have more information on this in weeks to come. I'm not entirely privy on what the legal ins and outs of the struggle have been. But if you want to plug in, be at June 5th, be at the Union Square on June 5th at 5 p.m. And let's see what's going to be happening there. The Union Square Partnership, the schemers behind the scam, will hold their annual backslapping self-congratulation dinner just a block or two off the park. We will gather at the northwest corner for a raucous rally and celebration of freely assembled people in public space. Expect marching bands, a Heroes of Union Square walking tour, which I'm sure would include Emma Goldman and Sacco and Vanzetti and et cetera, community visioning sessions, and soapbox preaching. Expect surprises and spectacles and a glimpse of what the city can be. Come out and meet your neighbors in the square and defend the public's right to public space. So once again, June 5th, this Thursday, 5 p.m., northwest corner of Union Square. I'm going to try to be there. You should, too. So, Chris Carlson, in the face of, you know, this kind of contraction of, you know, just basic elbow room for freedom and the hypertrophy of capital's control of public space and culture, why have you, speaking as a, you know, dyed-in-the-wool New York City crab and pessimist, why have you given your book such an optimistic title as Nowtopia?
I guess it must be because I'm from that positive part of the world, San Francisco. No, I'm actually a genuinely optimistic person in general, and think that you know, there, what I wanted to do was really address the fact that there are so many interesting initiatives going on that are politically and often socially and culturally pretty invisible. And these are initiatives that I consider to be examples of what I call self-emancipatory behaviors, that people, you know, if I believe in a possibility of human revolution, that I think we can actually change the world in a really dramatic way. And if that's true, then it ought to be something that you can actually observe in people's daily lives. It's not going to be some, you know, magic moment that descends upon us from on high, or that some small coterie of people come up with some brilliant idea and they just transform everything for everybody else. No, it'll actually be all of us normal people in our normal behaviors finding ways to build a society based on mutual aid and cooperation and solidarity, which we actually do all the time anyway, and it becomes the raw material for being converted into commodities by capital. And so what I was interested in was looking at the activities that I see around me where people take their time and their technological know-how out of the market, and they do really interesting things with that, and they work quite hard. And it turns out that sort of radical labor politics is not happening very much at work these days. It does seem to me, on the other hand, to be happening when you're not at work, where you're working quite hard. And so in looking at that constellation of behaviors, I came up...
Okay, radical labor politics.
Well, you know, we kind of got stuck with this paradigm out of the 20th century that says that if you're interested in transforming human activity that we call work, the best thing you can do is to organize with your fellow workers at a wage labor workplace under the control of capital, and mostly try to get more money and maybe get some health care and, you know, get a little more control over the process. But one
right,
of the,
and now we have decreasing ability to do even that.
Yeah, no, yeah. Obviously that struggle is failing on its own terms.
Exactly.
But regardless of that, there's a huge issue that got left behind in the process of codifying labor struggles in that way, and that is the question of what do we do? And the larger question of the aggregate division of labor globally and locally and throughout human society. Most of the work human beings do, in my opinion, is a total waste of time if it's not actually screwing things up really badly. And so there's whole swaths of what we call our economy, which is this crazy fiction, which is just all of us going to work all day every day, that ought to be abolished tomorrow, and we would be wealthier as human beings for it if we were to do so. Banking, insurance, real estate, advertising, military production.
Right, but the argument is that the system would collapse, and there wouldn't be bread and butter, and
well, I just don't believe
schools
that.
And mass transit and everything else that we need.
Right, that's to me patently obviously not true. That what makes all those things go today are human beings getting up and going to work and making them go. And it would be very interesting to me to propose living in a society in which we get up and go to work to do the things that we together decide are worth doing. And that would be all the things you just listed: getting the bread and butter, making the mass transit go, having decent communication systems, having good ways to maintain a healthy and complex urban life together. But to me, that should be the real issues of politics and democracy. And right now, it's completely invisible. It does not even come up. We don't discuss it at all. What we do is we go to work and we try to be political in our spare time after work, writing checks or carrying picket signs or going to protests or being good cultural consumers or really good shoppers. A lot of people think that's the gist of politics these days, is to be a good shopper.
Yes.
If you just buy the right products, you've done the best you can, end of discussion.
Right, and hence the hypertrophy of Whole Foods here in New York
right.
City.
Right, yeah, and there's a million examples of that. And so my argument is that, you know, the political possibilities that are in front of us require a refocusing of our energy, of our thoughts and our behaviors on what we do. It's really that simple.
Isn't this what the Situationist basically called the revolution of everyday life? It kind of ties in
yeah,
with that.
Yeah, I appreciate
thing.
That. Yeah, no, absolutely. And actually, in my book, too, I do refer to that, their body of thought. It's a very important reference point for all of us. Because my argument about, I think I like, you know, the fact that you're using some of the original quotes from the Society of the Spectacle, but I kind of always trying to find a fresher language, because I always found the original Society of the Spectacle kind of difficult. I think many people who pick it up kind of oh my God, you know, what am I going to do with that?
Rather obscurantist.
Yeah, yeah, but actually the comments on the Society of the Spectacle, the second volume that he wrote back in 93 came out, and that to me is way more clear as an average reading experience, and I recommend people checking that out for sure. Mm-hmm. But I basically just like to find a colloquial way to summarize this experience of living in a Society of the Spectacle, which is that we live in a state in which we're kind of made to feel lonely, isolated, and insecure about the truth of our lives. We don't even really believe that what we're living is true. What we believe is that there's this story about how life is, and it's the best of all possible worlds, and our own story doesn't quite match it somehow. We actually don't live in that world, but we're told over and over again that we do. And so if we're not in that world and we're living and not feeling the sense of the best of all, must be something wrong with me personally.
Well, that propaganda is still very strong, but it's beginning to show some cracks.
Well, I think every aspect of
the price of oil spiraling out of control.
Right. And there's many ways in which the propaganda that sustains a society is suffering a crisis of legitimation, to say the least. But it doesn't really show up yet. And that's part of the spectacular society, is that it's a univocal system that keeps repeating itself ad nauseum over and over again, saying it's the best of all possible worlds. Mm-hmm. Who could possibly complain? There's no dissent. End of story. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, people are getting more skeptical about things like television news and whatnot, but it only goes to a certain level. There's always some other way to co-opt this sort of radicalness.
I mean, I think the deepest problem is that people mistrust their own experience. Like, they don't actually believe what they're living as being the truth of life, and it's not just their truth, but it's a common truth. And instead, they accept more or less as the common truth, the fake story that's being told. I mean, there's a great quote in the comments in the Society of the Spectacle that says, the truth is a moment of the false. And it's really that simple. It's like there's all this sense that we have, that's what life's really like, but the whole story is a lie. And I think that's something that is becoming increasingly clear to lots of people. Anyway, we can talk about all that forever, of course. It's a very long and complicated set of ideas. Now, Topia tries to take that and make it practical in the sense that, it's about looking at the kind of how do we get to the position we're in. So there's a chunk of the book that deals with the question of the labor movement in the 20th century and the evolution of this sort of disconnect between being radically engaged with work and the fact that most people aren't inclined to stick around. If they have a job that makes them unhappy or is oppressing them or underpaying them or whatever it is, insofar as it's possible, they get up and leave rather than sticking around and fighting. And that's made all these leftist organizers and union organizers tear their hair out now for several years or several decades, because they're not finding it easy to organize the unorganized, because for the most part those people are saying, hey, I'm not interested in sticking around here, I'd rather go and do something else. But my experience, I come out of doing this magazine for a long time called Processed World.
Yes.
It came out from 1981 to 94, and then we did a couple of them in the new century, and you can find that at processedworld.com. a lot of it's online. But and when we started that magazine back in 1981, a lot of us were working in the financial district in San Francisco, and we had various degrees of education, either fully getting a credential or BAs or dropping out of college, as the case may be. And what do you really learn to do with a liberal arts education? Handle information. So when you go out to get employed, you don't get hired to be a philosopher or a historian or a photographer or a dancer or any of the things that we really thought we were and wanted to be. You get hired to handle information, and you end up working in an insurance company or an office or a bank or whatever. And you get stuck there, and it's like, what am I doing here? You know, this stuff is just pointless. This doesn't do anything but just keep the circulation of capital going. It has no bearing whatsoever on human well-being or my own creative satisfaction. So the magazine was founded essentially to create a place where people could talk to each other horizontally from those workplaces at a time when the Internet wasn't really a presence in our lives yet. Hard to fathom for people who never lived in that world. But so what we found is that we were living, and this has been the, sort of the source of the rise of my whole way of thinking that led to the book Nowtopia, is we live a bifurcated life. We have one world that we live in which we go to get our money. And it's usually something we don't really like very much, or we grudgingly endure it. And then, you know, a few people get a good job and they like it and they feel very satisfied, but it's really not so common. And then most people are doing something in, for money that they just really kind of detest, and they have to go through with it just to keep the bills paid. And then when they're not at work, they're alive and they're doing things that they choose to do that mean something to them, that they gives fulfills them in a really deep sense. And they're actually, in my opinion, are often doing things that are actually quite useful. They're actually doing things that address the ecological crisis, for instance. They're working on grassroots technologies, like almost doing R&D programs around how to reinvent the technology of transportation, whether it be the DIY bike shops that are proliferating around the world. Actually, I saw quite a bit of that in Italy. Or the invention of biofuels from below. Now we have a, you know, the co-optation cycle going on with large agribusiness and oil companies taking it over and turning it into a nightmare. But the impetus for it comes from below. It comes from people in the grassroots who are dissatisfied with just accepting the expertise of large companies and the government officials and academic leaders saying, this is the way it is. These are the only choices available. This is how technology works. You take these options and that's the end of the story. No, people are thinking, no, let's actually reappropriate the possibilities in the technosphere. Let's reuse things in new ways. Let's think about completely different ways of doing things. And they can't do that while they're at work. They have to do it when they're not at work. But in that world where they're not at work, they work really hard. And so that's what I'm so interested in, because this bifurcated life ends up making us all feel like we're in this insane speed up where we're working two jobs. And then if we have an emotional life with our lover or family or whatever it might be, it feels like three jobs when we're frantic. And we don't even have time to meet our friends anymore. We never drop in on each other for coffee. We're 5 emails and 3 phone calls later, we're still trying to find the time where we can meet up for just a cup of coffee and a chat. So there's a speed up that we've been living through for the last 30 years. And the overarching sort of theoretical framework of my book is this notion of class composition, where at the last moment of, you know, capitalist crisis of profitability was the late 60s and early 70s, which corresponded also with a lot of social explosions and social movements and refusal of work and many other things. And so at that point, capital goes on the counterattack in the early 70s and begins to restructure the global economy. We now casually refer to this as globalization, but it, you know, globalization,
or free trade or neoliberalism.
Yeah, and of course that goes back a long time. There's been, you know, global trade going on for several centuries, but it really expanded quite a bit during this time. But what we can really say is that the process of restructuring the global economy based on global production cycles broke down the old industrial working class, and it really broke down the inner cities and the communities of people who lived together intact in communities and knew each other and worked together, lived by each other, had relationships, knew each other over generations, trusted each other, had the wherewithal, the memory even, the shared memories of winning struggles together that they'd been involved in over the years. And so most of what we know of that time in history, people were dispersed from that life. It was broken down through this process of people becoming more mobile, businesses moving, the rise of the service economy, et cetera. So you go through this kind of cycle over the last 40 years where you see that the old working class is just fragmented. So we call that essentially the decomposition of the class. And I'm arguing that what we're seeing now is this slowly emerging recomposition of the working class, but not on the forms that we once knew. It's no longer something that it's, oh, the, you know, workers band together in the big factories and they walk out waving the flag, the red banner. You know, no, it's not going to be like that.
Not here, not in the United States.
Yeah, maybe you'll see that in some parts of the world where they are newly industrialized. Because,
yes,
in fact, there's a larger industrial proletariat in the world today than there has been at any time in world history.
Right, precisely.
Yeah, no, I think that's important.
So, I mean, there's certainly plenty of that sort of thing going on in Mexico and South Korea.
Yeah, and these are like, there's a really good book, Forces of Labor, by Beverly Silver, that does a nice job of describing these sort of cycles of forming and and breakdown of working classes.
All right, but we're talking about the post-industrial world, particularly the United States.
Yeah, seeing what's happening in this time in our lives and looking at trying to situate it in terms of capitalist development and how we might find out.
All right, so the working class is reconstituting.
Yeah, and I want to make sure that it's understood that I understand the working class to be super broad. Like, I'm not thinking about only the people with a certain level of income and then everybody above them is middle class. I think the middle class and the working class are essentially the same group of people. And if you make $80,000 a year or you're making $8,000 a year, your conditions are more similar than not in terms of your relationship to the reproduction of everyday life on a broad scale. You don't have any power. You do what you're told. You go to your job. You get paid. You go home. You're supposed to do your political action every 4 years outside of all these other things that you're involved in every day. And Americans mostly feel comfortable with an apolitical life in which they're not expected to be involved with politics except in this kind of spectacular and limited way that's essentially competing advertising campaigns, then you're supposed to choose one. But in my opinion, everyday life is super political and everything we do is politicized, whether we think so or not, and it's mostly to our disadvantage to not recognize that. And the fact is that the common experience that we produce together in this life is something that we need to spend more time paying attention to, because we've ended up as a sort of, insofar as there are social movements left in the United States and things that might call themselves vaguely left, we spend a great deal of time beating each other up over our differences and thinking that, you know, oh, well, this level of oppression and that level of hierarchy. And this is all true. I don't want to denigrate people's experiences. They're actually specific and unique and important to emphasize and develop the histories and understand where they come from. We live in a society based on genocide and slavery. So the results of that are a wide, fragmented, and very brutally hierarchical society with a whole lot of different deals available for you depending on where you sit in all those different layers of hierarchy and overlapping layers of oppression. So you want to know where you're at. You know, you want to know where you fit into that world. But at the end of the day, regardless of where you fit into that world, all of us have reasons to be quite dissatisfied with this life. I mean, I'm a not poor middle-aged white guy, you know, straight white guy for that matter. I'm supposedly the beneficiary of this world. I want to tell you, it sucks. You know, it's like, this is not the world I want to live in. I would like to live in a world of free human beings where everybody's really dynamic and alive and engaged, and we make intelligent decisions together about how to live within the logic of nature.
All right,
and
so
ecology.
Of New York City's emergency alert system. This is only a test. In the event of a real emergency, this system would provide you with important information. This test of New York City's emergency alert system is now complete.
Okay. We're back yet? No, we're not back yet. We're back now? Okay. Before we were so rudely interrupted.
Talking about working class gets them really excited there at the authorities. You know, they have to come right in with their test. I would argue.
All right, so hang on. I'm not sure that my question was actually broadcast because we were rudely interrupted by the authorities. Playing, you know, the old leftist, you know, the devil's advocate thing here. And, you know, arguing for more of a Marxist orthodox position. In what sense is the working class being reconstituted if there is no more industrial proletariat to speak of in this country and people are just kind of, you know, in their free time vigorously pursuing things which the system can tolerate and ultimately co-opt, whether it is, and we could, you know, discuss all these, and we should discuss all these instances in greater detail, but, you know, whether it's people making vacant lots in their, you know, community gardens in the local vacant lots in their neighborhood, or DIY bike shops or whatever. How is any of this a reconstitution of the working class or a threat to the system?
Well, I would say, first of all, the working class never went away, and it's not really reconstituting. It's more,
that was your phrase.
Well, no,
right?
Recomposing. The composition idea is this. It's just important to be a little bit precise about it, because Yeah, I don't want to say that there's suddenly working class is gone, now it's coming back. That's a little bit wrong to say it that way. It got decomposed. That is to say, the social relationships and technical relationships of production have been radically altered over the last three to four decades. And now what I'm arguing is that there's a new quasi-stability. We have a period of great capitalist profitability, mostly financialized and speculative, but nevertheless, there's a way in which capitalist reproduction goes on day by day, which has put people into new relationships to work and work with each other in various ways. That's the technical composition of the class. It's new. It's different than it was 30 years ago or 40 years ago. Then there's also a social composition of the class, and that's where I start to look for this sort of notion of recomposition, because there was a social composition that existed some decades ago that I'm arguing has fallen apart, and the social norms that existed in that world are gone. And now we see the new ones appearing, and we don't use the word class, and we certainly don't use the word working class hardly at all. We barely think of class at all in the United States. And one of my points of this book was to go out and ask people about that and investigate it. And I would, I went to like
at such unlikely places as Burning Man.
Burning Man, exactly. That's where I went. And I was doing, you've all heard of Martinizing in front of the dry cleaner, and I was doing 1 hour scrutinizing. And so I'd ask people.
I'm sorry, Martinizing?
Yeah, I saw that word on the front of dry cleaners for a lot of years. I was 1 hour Martinizing. What is that? And so I got this idea when I went to Burning Man to do 1 hour scrutinizing.
Or what is Martinizing?
It's some sort of procedure, I presume.
Oh, you know, procedure.
Dry cleaning procedure. Anyway, so I was doing a different procedure. I was asking people, scrutinizing them, and they'd come running up to me. Oh, I want to be scrutinized. Like, okay, fine. You'd be like light scrutiny or heavy scrutiny. And then if they wanted heavy scrutiny, they sat down and did an audio interview with me for 45 minutes in which I'd ask them, what does the word class mean to you? And they would scratch their head and feel kind of uncomfortable and hem and haw and beat around the bush. And then I'd say, well, do you identify with the label middle class or the label working class or neither or both? And they'd get really confused oftentimes, and they'd say, well, you know, my dad used to do this and my mom did that, and I do this job now, but I have this college degree and I don't make that much money, but I used to and now I don't. And, any variation you can think of, they're all out there, and they're all just like kind of puzzled about this question. And then I kind of eventually get around to like, well, do you think there's a ruling class? And the answer almost always instantly, without any hesitation, yes. So my impression from this weird set of responses to these questions was that people really understood they lived in a class society, but
what do they mean by a ruling class? I mean, I find it refreshing that everybody said yes, but I mean, my fear is that class analysis is kind of being abandoned in favor of conspiracy theory, and people are less concerned about the ruling class than about the Bilderbergs and the Trilateral Commission and the Zionists.
You could be entirely right. I didn't go a lot further in that inquiry, so I wouldn't be able to answer that with any clarity, but my sense of it, the way I interpreted it, was that people understood they lived in a class society in which they were not in control, that they were not the ones running it, and somebody else was. And sometimes they said it's not a human being, it's actually a system. So I thought that was an intelligent wrinkle on the explanation. In any case, the point of recomposition of the class to me is that people talk more in terms of community. That's our common language. We use it to death. I mean, there's every kind of community out there that's laughable, doesn't really mean a thing. But in fact, people want that. They want to feel connected to each other. They want to feel a sense of engagement with each other, a sense of shared purpose, and a sense of shared life. And so we find people coming together in these new activities that I've described in the book, whether it be the outlaw bicycling subculture or the movement for urban gardening and food security in cities, or the permaculture movement, which is a whole new design science that involves rethinking our relationship to nature more broadly and figuring out ways to adapt our technological lives to a system that's in some sort of deep harmony with the logic of nature rather than contesting it. there's also a chapter on Burning Man, a chapter on free software movement is another example of people taking their time, their technological know-how, creating communities that do things. They do practical things together to make their lives better today. And insofar as they do those things, they actually start to create the foundations, both socially and technically, for a different kind of life, a post-capitalist life. That doesn't mean it's going to happen. I wouldn't go so far as to say that. What I'm trying to say is that there's the glimmer, the possibility in these moments of this beginning of a social movement, of recomposition of the class, that is to say people who work, who have better things to do than their jobs.
Okay, well, my next question would be that however positive all of this stuff may be and however fulfilling we personally find it, how does it challenge capital? Yeah. But before you answer that question, I should note that it is now 12:43 in the a.m. on listener-supported non-commercial WPAI 99.5 FM here in New York City. This is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. My name is Bill Weinberg, and we're speaking with Chris Carlson, who is the author of a new book entitled Nowtopia, How Pirate Programmers, Outlaw Bicyclists, and Vacant Lot Gardeners Are Inventing the Future Today. And we should talk about all of these examples in some greater detail after we take another musical break, I believe, from Thus Spoke the Spectacle. So, Eric Goodman, what cut should we play next from Thus Spoke the Spectacle?
Well, what do you feel like? You're interested in TV news or war or what's the... we can go with a little bit of everything. Second cut is Now This.
Uh-huh. That's, I would take it that's about news.
That's about news. It's based on a chapter from Neil Postman's Amusing Ourselves to Death.
Ah, okay.
And it basically, the video juxtaposes the doom and gloom of television news with the happy-go-lucky commercials that sponsor it.
Mm.
So in this audio track, I mean, you have to remember all this, you know, the music you hear. These are all, you know, the soundtracks to the videos. So in this track, you'll hear the doom and gloom part. You'll recognize that. What you won't see is the juxtaposition to those, which is in the happy imagery of the commercials.
Yes.
If you come down and see the show at the Living Theater or check it out on our website, thespectacle.net, you'll see the full video. It's also on our YouTube channel, Spectacle Show. That gives you, you know, the full idea. But I think from playing the music, you'll be able to, you'll just get a sense of what the video is about, and you will hear that one side of it, which is the doom and gloom. And this is what Postman and Marshall McLuhan and these guys were talking about in terms of the, you know, juxtaposing that, you know, that horrible stuff, the fear generated by that with the relief response triggered by the commercial. So it's about that juxtaposition.
Yes, which I believe was also summed up in the stage name of the lead singer of the Dead Kennedys, Jello Biafra. Okay, and so that's going to be cut two. And just a reminder to the listeners that they can witness Thus Spoke the Spectacle 1 week from tonight, Tuesday, June 10th, 7 p.m. at the Living Theater at 21 Clinton Street on the Lower East Side.
Familiar faces. Smiling, reliable friends. Never late, never a hair out of place. Just the right lack of emotion to fill the seconds of our lives with novelty and death. Celebrities in their own right, liaisons to the world of gruesome tales and fleeting obsessions. The grotesque, the absurd, the insane are mere decoys. It is the psychic overload that drives us into the marketplace in delirious frenzy, seeking salvation. Morning, noon, and night, we witness the ritual sacrifice of truth to ratings as our smiling friends lead the assault on coherence with the strangest of all voices.
Murder of a New York City cop.
Plane crash made for chaos.
Body was found floating in the water.
Dark alley of destruction and death.
Unconscious and covered with bruises.
Plot to bomb New York subways.
Brutal attack.
Sex assault.
All hopes of peace seem to be shattered tonight.
May be a victim of abuse. 70th prison torture scandal.
The dominatrix found murdered this weekend.
The discovery of mutilated animals.
It was an amazing day on Wall Street.
an attack on a woman in Central Park. Helicopter disaster.
Missing money.
Stabbing death.
Murder, domination.
Dark alley of destruction and death. Destruction.
Plane crash.
Assault. Stabbing. Torture. Mutilated.
Murdered.
Murder.
Murdered.
Death.
How cheerful. So that was a little sample from Thus Spoke the Spectacle, once again produced by Eric Goodman and
Mike Stevens,
who are both going to be performing. Once again, a week from tonight, Tuesday, June 10th, 7 p.m. at the Living Theater, 21 Clinton Street. So it's the next cut after that, which is about war?
Yeah, it's about the propaganda campaign leading up to the invasion of Iraq.
Ah, WMD Blues.
That's correct.
Is it, in fact, a blues?
It is a blues. The reason was that trying to illustrate the repetitive nature of propaganda. So thinking about how to do that, it seemed to make perfect sense with the...
Make it a 12-bar blues.
The 12-bar repetitive refrain over the 1 and 4 chord. And the challenge was really to try to make it sound musical. I mean, I had a million clips from... I had taped, you know, so much stuff, and I had a lot of just everybody in there. And I think that real, well-done propaganda, sophisticated propaganda, is very musical. And that's one of its appeals, why it sticks in people's heads and why it gets people to think in a certain way that they do. So the challenge was to try to take all these sound bites and try to, you know, like I said before, the spectacle is the lead vocalist of our project, in a sense. And so to try to work that in as a vocal and make it sound right. And at the same time, we have you'll recognize... The lead vocal, the lead people are obviously voices you'll recognize and then there's the background singers, supposedly, who are other ones who are giving you that background propaganda and the reinforcement. And after Bush makes a speech, they all fan out on the Sunday shows and all that. So it was trying to get those all worked out well between, like, the lead vocals, the background vocals, and make it sound musical. That was our goal, and you can be the judge of it. But
all right. Well, maybe in around 15 minutes we'll play WMD Blues and then decide if we want to continue talking amongst ourselves or entertain some listener phone calls, if anybody wants to call in. So, Chris Carlson, once again, Nowtopia, how pirate programmers, outlaw bicyclists, and vacant lot gardeners are inventing the future today. Okay, these are all movements which I've been involved in to a certain extent, or at least the latter two are, not the programming stuff, because I'm completely an idiot and alienated when it comes to anything digital, as all my friends know all too well. But certainly I've been involved in the gardening movement in the Lower East Side, and with the what you call outlaw bicyclist movement. And I'll note that that's a rather provocative phrase, and not everybody who's involved in it would necessarily embrace that.
I mean it in somewhat of a humorous fashion as well. I don't actually think most bicyclists that fall into this category are busily breaking the law, although, there's a kind of routine behaviors that we are all engaged in, running red lights and stop signs or, being somewhat scofflaw in terms of our behavior.
Critical Mass prides itself on, their slogan is, we're not stopping traffic, we are traffic.
Right. Yeah. And then, once we are traffic, we actually think it's a good idea for our safety to stick together and continue in a mass rather than let it get broken up into a bunch of smaller ones and have traffic in between, which Actually, I just had that interesting experience in Italy where motorcyclists and scooters are super aggressive there, and they just punch their way into the ride and then try to force their way all the way to the front, which is just like mind-boggling.
So right.
On the Friday night ride in Rome, they didn't do a very good job of stopping that, but on the Saturday ride, they did a great job. People just corked them and stopped them on the spot. So, it needs a lot of internal management. But in the broader scheme of this outlaw bicycling subculture, you have all these people that are, you know, working on making these strange hybrid art bikes and finding, you know, discarded bicycles and bicycle parts everywhere thrown out in the big trash days in suburbia or even in urban environments and, essentially repoing a lot of that stuff and putting it to other purposes, repurposing it as well as repossessing it. And there's this series of political and social, not necessarily political, but certainly social experiences that come out of this. There's a lot of cultural bike rides that have sometimes a very deliberate political meaning, sometimes very indirect and even none at all. You know, sometimes they're strictly pleasure-oriented, but to me that is political. Like if you were coming together with a group of friends and in a society that is fundamentally atomized and broken down and isolating, you're already doing something that has some really interesting political implications for bringing people back together again with a purpose, doing something where you're re-inhabiting urban life, you know, taking your public space and making it your own. And a lot of times people do that and they have these little impromptu street parties or block parties and they have, you know, this one long bike I know in Portland frequently goes out with a grill on it and starts grilling burgers and people are drinking beer and they just make this thing happen. And I think, you know, in a society where we don't get very many opportunities to meet each other and just have unmediated space to hang out and talk and socialize with each other, this is a deeply political act. So, that, you know, there's not that much law-breaking going on most of the time. If there is, it's really trivial almost always. But this kind of scofflaw attitude towards safety is another aspect of the subculture that I think is quite prevalent. And certainly the bike messengers that we all know and love have a rather elaborate subculture within the bicycling world and within the working class more broadly, in which they're very busily, you know, doing what they need to do to speed around the city and deliver the packages and make the money that they want to make without any concern whatsoever for what the official rules are of how you should move yourself around in an urban environment.
Okay, and what's your view of that?
Oh, I think it's absolutely fine. I think that, you know, there's a courtesy issue for pedestrians that I think is
a safety issue.
And, of course, a safety issue, which comes right hand in hand with that. And I don't think there's any justification for barreling down the sidewalk or running pedestrians down on the street. That's just unacceptable. So, you know, there's that. That's just a basic courtesy of human beings amongst each other trying to live in a complex and dense urban environment. You know, there needs to be some basic respect. But the kind of respect that we don't get from automobiles and drivers, for the most part, I think is more the issue, because that's far more likely to end in a fatality than anything any bicyclist ever does. So I think in terms of culpability and concern for public safety and concern with, you know, the ethics of cohabitation in a city, the behavior of motorists is always a bigger issue than the behavior of bicyclists, even though the bicyclists tend to get scapegoated and blamed a lot more often for problems in city traffic.
Right, but there are instances of, shall we say, bad facts which allow that to happen. I mean, there is bad behavior by bicyclists.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, even in critical mass, you see a lot of bad behavior. What's one of the interesting aspects of it to me is the fact that you go out into a big, huge public ride with hundreds or thousands of other cyclists, you're definitely going to have some antisocial behavior from both cyclists and motorists and pedestrians. And that's interesting to me. Like, that doesn't seem like a problem. That seems like, you know, anybody that thinks anything you do should have only angelically perfect behavior from all of the participants is just delusional. It's just like, why would you even make that an issue? It's not the point. Everything anybody does in society, go to a hockey game or go to any kind of a sports event or go to a concert, and you're going to have antisocial behavior. Some people are going to be creeps, and they're going to act badly. That just happens. So the problem then is, what do you do about it? How do you deal with that in the moment? And that's why I like critical mass as a sort of a laboratory of social self-management, of people actually figuring it out in the moment under the pressure of nobody's in charge here. We have to solve this problem together right now. This motorist is trying to hurt somebody. This bicyclist is acting like a jerk. We have to get in their face and talk to them and recompose what's happening amongst ourselves. Let's renegotiate. Let's
work it out. It's real.
It's super real. Yeah.
And that's what a lot of people, I think, are not used to right now is reality. If you spend all your time sitting in front of a TV set or, you know, just imbibing all spectacle stuff, you are very unused to a genuine situation.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I appreciate you bringing that up, because in a way, what I'd like to say about the bicycle is that it's an anti-spectacular device. It's still a technical, you know, industrial technological item, to make no mistake, and it's bloody history of where it comes from, the slavery in the Congo and the Amazon for the rubber that was fueled by the boom in bicycling in the latter part of the 19th century can't be ignored, nor the bicyclist's urgent embrace of asphalt and good roads in the 1890s as well. But as we get into our current period of history, the bicycle ends up being an intelligent choice for lots of reasons, and one of them is because it allows you to experience life directly. You're going down the street on your bicycle, you smell things, you hear things, you see people, you see your friend, you pull over right away and you're in a conversation. No waiting, you know, no looking for a parking place, hoping they might still be somewhere where you can find them 20 minutes later when you get back. It's an immediate and unmediated experience.
All right, and you juxtapose this, what you call outlaw bicyclist culture, with bicycle consumerism and the whole sort of co-optation.
Well, I think everything in my book, all the examples that I come up with are all, have their own demise within them. And one of the obvious ones around bicycling is that you can have a perfectly happy capitalist society full of, you know, spandex-clad high-tech bike riders who are riding around, you know, consuming lots of products and doing everything like any normal American, you know, ideal consumer does. So you don't automatically become a radical by riding a bicycle. And so there's plenty of them who are absolutely not radical. You know, in fact, I have one whole category of bicyclists that I tend to refer to as Republican efficiency freaks, because they're actually quite conservative culturally and politically. The thing they like about bicycles is they're so efficient. And they want everybody to behave like perfect angels all the time. And they actually hate people who advocate for separate bikeways and side paths, which is like a normal civilized thing to do in most cities of Europe, for instance, more Northern Europe. In the United States, you
know. Why do they oppose that?
Well, they oppose it on the grounds that it's less safe. They actually are usually acolytes of a guy named John Forrester, who's a rocket scientist at Stanford and wrote this big fat book that's their Bible called Effective Cycling. And in that book, he argues that to be an effective cyclist, you need to be on the road for 10,000 hours. And then you become like a car. You ride like a car in traffic and no problem. And, of course, if you're a good cyclist, you do learn how to do that in big cities. And it's to your advantage because you're far more mobile than the cars. But to make that the presupposition of your being an urban cyclist, that you're going to have 10,000 hours on the road, is ridiculous. Where are you going to get it from? How are you going to get started? So the idea that we want to make an urban transformation towards a far more slowed down, friendly city where people talk and meet and have a share of the public space in ways that are both safe and endearing, requires the move towards redesigning how we use the physical space that's our last remaining commons, i.e. the streets. Part of it, in my opinion, we should dig up half of every street and start farming there. That would be an obvious thing to do. A great number of urban centers are actually built on great farmland, and the land has obviously been destroyed by being paved over. So depaving is one of the urgent tasks.
Right, which brings us to your next example, which is vacant lot gardeners.
Yeah, and that's a place where, you know, the move towards vacant lot gardening also comes out of this notion of sort of the breakdown of the class back in the 70s. You know, gardening goes back a long way, of course. You know, people have always done it themselves and grown food in where they live.
Right? In fact, the Victory Gardens in the Second World War.
Well, that was the big example that's really interesting for people who kind of scratch their head and go, what do you mean we could grow food in cities and feed ourselves? That's ridiculous. And the fact is that at the end of World War II, Americans were getting 45% of their fresh produce out of gardens in cities, because that was a big push to do that. And so there, in the city of San Francisco that I know the best, we had 70,000 Victory Gardens.
And, wow.
Yeah, and, you know, in a tiny little city like that. So the notion that we could do it is obviously true. And so, you know, figuring out how to make a transition towards that, part of it is the re-inhabitation of the physical spaces that have been abandoned in cities, either through landlord neglect or arson or through city planning, you know, failures, et cetera. And, you know, we have this whole series of social explosions and rebellions in the 60s and 70s that burned down chunks of whole cities, and especially here in the East. And
well, not just social rebellion, but landlord arson.
Well, I mentioned that, yeah. But you have, at the same time, in that same period of social rebellion, a sudden turn towards the need for fresh organic food. And so these things kind of dovetail together, and there's a certain part of the culture in these cities where the working class has been broken down and dispersed. The people who are left behind, oftentimes women-led families and communities, start to re-inhabit those abandoned lives. I mean, you know the story better than I do because you've written about it here, and I quote your book several times in mine. Avant Gardening, very nice little book that you did
with Peter Lamborn Wilson, yeah. With whom I used to co-host his radio show.
Yeah, by Autana Media, a very nice little publication. So I recommend that book to everyone. It's a very good history of the gardening movement here in New York, far better than I can do. But in any case, you see a broader movement in cities all across the East and even in San Francisco and to some extent in other cities in the West. Of people going and finding those empty spaces that have been abandoned or left unused for some period of time and feeling this real urgent need to reconnect to the ecology of where they live, to find a way to make a community space where there isn't one. And people come together around sharing that re-emergent knowledge. It's not new knowledge. It's stuff people have known how to do for a millennia, actually going long before capitalism or any kind of heavy urbanization, is how to grow food directly in the land near where you live. And, as we go through the post-World War II era and everything becomes, supermarketized and wrapped in cellophane and brought to you by agribusiness, there's a real sudden urge to get away from that and do it yourself and find a way to produce your own food. And actually in producing food together, or at least beautiful flowers, as the case may be, and making these community spaces places that you can bring your children and hang out or hang out with your elders, and it's safe, it's comfortable, it's pleasant, you meet new people. And there's a place where you're actually growing your community, you're growing your souls together and having this kind of new sense of knowing who you're with and learning to trust each other and beginning to have conversations that might actually envision a different kind of life.
Right. And the unfortunate sinister side of this is that, as we've certainly found on the Lower East Side, as through, these kind of grassroots efforts of people wanting to reclaim their neighborhoods from rats and junkies and just blasted, blitzed lots and actually turning them into pleasant green spaces, well, then all of a sudden these neighborhoods become a little bit more desirable.
Right, yes. And the private property issue ends up being the...
Exactly. The very people who, by the sweat of their brow, reclaimed these vacant lots and turned them into these pleasant little gardens find themselves being priced out and pushed out.
Or actually violently dispossessed in the case of many of those gardens where
they
came right in.
So, right.
And that happened in L.A. just a couple of years ago in 2006.
Sort of victims of their own success in a certain sense.
Well, I mean, what it speaks to is that there's this interesting impulse. It's an interesting set of behaviors that come out of it. It creates this beautiful, kind of re-inhabitation of the urban environment on an ecological basis that grows community, that grows a deeper knowledge. And it failed because insofar as it did, I mean, some of these are still going and there's some beautiful gardens going that are still quite important. But insofar as that effort was defeated and failed or led to just a cycle of gentrification, it's precisely because the issue of property ownership wasn't addressed. And this notion of it being a commons, which is a perfectly reasonable thing to see it as, is not entirely true unless the property ownership got resolved and turned into a permanent land trust or some sort of commonly held space. And it was done in practice, but it wasn't done on paper. And so at the end of the day, if you don't address that issue when it's dirt cheap or being ignored and get some sort of unlawful possession deal going, or however the language is for different, the law is different in every place, you lose in the end.
And so adverse possession, call it here in New York anyway.
Yeah, I've heard different expressions. Yeah. But anyway, so there's ways of doing that, but it takes a certain level of engagement with the state and with the law that a lot of us are just adverse to. Why would we want to go and do all that? It's such an unpleasant thing. We might not win. It might be a huge amount of effort for no end. But
yes.
But somehow we need to be addressing this issue insofar as we don't have a radical overthrow of private property across the board.
Right.
Then insofar as we want to create spaces where these kinds of initiatives can flourish, we need to figure out how to remove them forever from market life.
Yes.
And there are some mechanisms that have been developed by people who have concerned themselves with this, the obvious one being land trusts, where land is permanently taken off the market. And if there's a building on it, then the building can be turned into a limited equity co-op. If there's not, it could be left as permanent open space. In San Francisco, what happened is that due to popular pressure, there was an initiative placed on the ballot, and it was passed, and it created an open space fund. And the city has X millions of dollars every year to spend on acquiring open space and making them available for people to do other things. A lot of it just ends up going into the Parks and Rec Department, but some of these, we have about 120 community gardens in the rather small city of San Francisco, And each one of them are their own little curious amalgamation of democracy / dictatorships, and you never really know until you go in and try to get a plot in one and see what kind of life is going on in a given garden. So, but this, again, to me, is a case of it. It's interesting. It's not a problem that it's not all homogenized and all fits a certain model and it's all figured out. It's actually a case where human beings are engaged in an interesting social process that is fraught with contradictions, like almost everything we do is. And it forces you to face up to things in ways, and to face up to it communally and collectively in ways that very few things do in our society. And it allows you to specifically get, if you get through the process and you create a garden, you're not only having worked out some of this community stuff and social relationship stuff, and you're in the midst of continuing to do that to maintain the place, you're also connecting to the local ecology of where you live. You're dealing with water, you're dealing with land, you're dealing with what can grow in that microclimate. And these are like really essential bits of knowledge that have been more or less expunged over the decades, and now are coming back in a rather interesting and almost a renaissance of this going on, I think, in many parts of the United States, and actually turns out many parts of the world. I mean, the food crisis going on right now in the world would be way worse if there weren't so many women growing gardens in their front of their houses all over the global South. That's, you know, an unbelievable resource that doesn't come into the conversation when people are talking about the international food crisis right now.
What was the case in L.A. that you briefly touched on?
There was a thing called the South Central Farm that had started out as a big, huge, empty lot across the street from a food bank in South Central L.A., and the food bank sort of saw that land just sitting there and was working very hard to get food donations and distribute it to poor families, mostly Spanish-speaking immigrants, and thought, well, let's see if we can get a chance to use that land and have people grow food of their own. And they got permission to do that. And the city took over the land actually through eminent domain and owned it for a while. And there's some really confusing story here because I never really sorted out all the legal ins and outs. But apparently one of the city council members in L.A., made a backdoor deal with the original owner to give it back to him at a cut rate price less than the city had bought it for. And after several years of 300 families feeding themselves on this rather large plot of land. And so all these celebrities like Daryl Hannah and various people came down there and tried to save the garden. And they had this big cause celeb around that for about 6 months. But finally the sheriff's department came in and bulldozed this whole place and put up a fence around it.
And this was what, about 2 years ago?
Yeah, it was in 06 when this came to its demise. But that group of families has stuck together. And somebody gave them some land out in the Central Valley, which is a pretty long place, long, far away from where they are, but at least there is some food growing for the families directly going on in this place, you know, about 70 or 80 miles north. And they continue to organize, they continue to seek to get the land returned to them, and on the grounds that it's rightfully theirs after having farmed it for all that time. Now, I think there's a warehouse going up on it, so they're not going to have quite the same resource at the end. But anyway, that's an example. Another one that came up recently is the Detroit Agricultural Network, which has got this deal with the city of Detroit where you can just come and fill out a one-page form and get land to farm, because the whole swaths of the inner city have been going back to nature for quite a long time in Detroit, and it's now really pretty possible to have a decent enough chunk of land that you need a tractor to farm it.
Wow.
And you can get that land for signing a piece of paper from
no
the
kidding.
City. Yeah, because,
wow.
You know, they lost it all during those huge burnings and riots in the 60s, and mostly in the late 60s there. And, you know, it just has gone back to nature. It's really interesting. Rebecca Solnit wrote a nice piece about that, actually, and that was in Harper's about a year ago.
Hmm.
So you can also, apparently, it's quite easy to go and visit.
And the final example in your subtitle, which we haven't touched on yet, is pirate programmers, which I must confess is the example I'm most skeptical about.
Well, there's different layers of it to think about. First of all, there's this thing we all use all the time, the internet, right? And that has been a product of a lot of people doing free labor in their spare time to create, or they're just, whether they have spare time or not, they just do it for free. They've created these amazing software tools that are the backbone of a great deal of what we depend on the internet. There's a huge number of tools that have been created by people who didn't do it for money that allow us to get things for free on the internet. The entire internet is a giant collaboration done by tons of technically minded people and creative people working together all the time, and all of us have in some ways had the beginnings of an epistemological shift, a shift in how we know the world based on our engagement with this world of the internet, because we get it that there's this unlimited abundance and that we can contribute to that as we feel like, and we can take from it as we need or desire. And that's a really interesting material experience of the world of, you know, virtual world of not really products a lot of the time, although sometimes they are. But even when they're products, we're pretty often stealing them. I mean, how many of us have free software on our computers? How many of us have songs that we didn't buy through a commercial situation? Almost all of us. And so there's something very interesting about that process that's going on that's dependent on a lot of programmers doing a lot of work without necessarily any kind of remuneration other than the thrill of being recognized for doing something cool. Then there's programmers who've seen that there's these tools out there that exist, and they're committed to various social initiatives. So one of the guys that I profile in the book is a guy named Guillermo Payet, who's a guy who used to be a Peruvian programmer for IBM, and he came to the United States and started a small business, and it went belly up in the dot-com bust. But while he had it going, and then afterwards, he kept working on this other project when he wasn't doing his commercial gigs, and it was to create this thing called localharvest.org, and that allows small farmers all over the United States to connect directly with each other and the people who want to consume and buy their products, which again is, you know, kind of an interesting dilemma, and it's one of those little weird ironies that we exist with. The slow food movement, which started in Italy some years ago, has gained some adherence here in the United States as well, and is growing rather rapidly all over the northern hemisphere, and actually connecting with people in the global south as well. And one of the ironies of slow food as a movement is that it recognizes, the same thing with this local harvest project, is that it recognizes that to save these artisanal ways of producing cheeses and salamis and all sorts of different products, as well as preserving the biodiversity of agriculture, you need to create markets for these different products or nobody will grow them. And so as an anti-capitalist, I always kind of cringe when I realize, well, it's true. In this time of history, without a market of free for everybody to share without anybody worrying about it, even that might be our goal, I mean, certainly mine, in the short term, just to make sure all these things don't disappear and the knowledge of how to grow them doesn't disappear and the actual physical existence of all these species don't disappear, it's a pretty smart idea to create these direct markets that cut out the middlemen, cut out agribusiness, and
right.
let the small
but
farmers
what tends to happen is that they tend to become boutiqueified and just sort of a luxury for the rich.
But in the case of the slow food phenomenon, and certainly a lot of these local harvest, these are not rich people. These are small farmers selling small batches of things to, maybe to the local restaurant that has expensive dinners, sure.
Right. It doesn't have to be that
way.
But
you can go down and visit them
directly.
There's
a tendency towards that.
Yeah, well, that's a tendency that exists throughout a capitalist society, right? That, you know, things that are desirable and in
short
supply.
But my greater critique of the whole pirate programmer trip is that, well, first of all, I mean, there's this sense that there's this unlimited abundance out there, but abundance of what? And, you know, certainly my particular mode of interaction with the internet has been journalism. And I think that the whole profession of journalism has been very much degraded by the hypertrophy of the internet.
Uh-huh.
I think that, you know, editorial standards and journalistic standards for accuracy and depth have really, really degraded.
Mm-hmm.
There's more of a tendency towards, flash and, shallow soundbite. People don't want to read long articles because they're on a screen. And then even, you know, print papers are now disappearing.
Yeah, I agree with all that. That's absolutely true. And I think, you know, there's plenty of things that we can talk about, the negative social results of the internet, and the journalistic critique is really, I think, on the mark. I completely share that criticism, and I'm frustrated with it as well. I'm an author, you know. I have a novel, actually, After the Deluge, which you can download for free, but no one who wants to read a PDF. You know,
right.
I'd rather buy a book. And
exactly.
So my book is also for sale, and mm-hmm. I have it for sale, but I don't sell very many books. And people have downloaded I sold about 800 books. I've had 18,000 downloads.
And the second thing is that even if you're using some, you know, groovy free software program like Unix or whatever, it's still, it's in this, mediated world of, ones and zeros where, we're spending more and more time looking into a screen and giving ourselves carpal tunnel syndrome.
Right.
Well, and the government is watching every keystroke.
No doubt. No doubt that's true. Well, I can't argue with you about that. That's just a fact. But I also would argue separately that there's another way to look at some of the same information, which is that if you, as I do, have a desire to live in a free world in which we don't have to take orders from on high, that there has to be some way to self-manage a complex society. whatever you want to say about how that might work, I would argue that you're going to need to have very good communication skills, and you're going to need some sort of communication technologies that facilitate lots of people figuring things out together. And there really isn't anything else on the horizon other than a non-commercial internet, some version of it. And I think that a lot of the programmers that have spent a lot of their time unpaid working on creating these tools do have that vision. And that's part of the argument of that chapter, is that they see the necessity of creating essentially what they call infrastructure for the movement. And a lot of the people that use this stuff use it for social networking, use it for political networking. And, of course, we can talk about the Zapatistas and the No Globo movement and the People's, you know, Global Action movement and all these things, the February 15, 2003 anti-war demos, as interesting examples of people using this technology for purposes of actually going into the streets or taking political action in the world. But I'm interested in this issue that I brought up at the beginning of the evening around the aggregate division of labor. Like, why do we do the work we do, and shouldn't we do something else? And I think that is something we could figure out together democratically and not having to have it all figured out by bureaucrats in some office somewhere telling us what the answer is. I think it's only going to work if we do it together. But we can't do it together by just having face-to-face meetings everywhere. We actually have to have some way to know the data on what does it take to produce the things we want. Like, if we all say, yeah, we can all have everything we want, well, what is that list? It's probably kind of too long. It means we all have to work too hard. So, okay, well, how do we back up from there? And what are the ecological consequences of all that stuff? And, well, who's going to do all the work? And what are the ecological consequences? Those are the real issues, and we need the data. And how are we going to have that data for a democratic decision-making process if there's not some sort of elaborate communication system? In which case, if we have a society that's making an interesting transition to a more healthy relationship to all these decisions, we might actually spend less time looking at a screen and more time spending just living with each other and putting our hands in the soil and doing something useful.
Theoretically.
Yeah, in theory, of course, all of this stuff is at that level. It's all about seeing the glimmering hopes and the beginnings of things that could actually change the world that aren't strange and alien and different from what we're actually doing already. They're actually in our lives with stuff we already do. And the idea is to expand that stuff and to expand it with the self-consciousness that the market is the problem, the sale and commodification of human time and the products of that activity. That's the problem. Then from there, we can make other decisions about which technologies to use or get rid of, how to organize which work needs to be done or not be done. I think one of the urgent tasks is to get rid of a good deal of the work we do, as I mentioned earlier. And then, you know, from there, all these other things kind of flow naturally. I think we could easily imagine if this conversation shifted in this direction in a broad way, a lot of other transformations would follow. The urban environment would become much richer and much greener and much more engaging as a place to spend your time and doing meaningful work. You'd have a lot of time, you know, moving through it. You'd be moving a lot slower. You'd be in less of a hurry. You'd have more time for everything that's good in life, on and on and on. So,
well, we only have 10 minutes left, assuming that we're not going to go into extra innings. I should inform the listeners that Tom Whisker is indisposed tonight and is not going to be showing up. So probably Max Schmid is going to entertain you beginning in 10 minutes from now, unless we decide to go into extra innings, which I'm not sure any of us want to do necessarily. But why don't we hear WMD Blues from Thus Spoke the Spectacle and decide what we want to do with the remaining less than 10 minutes we'll have at that point. So that's cut four, Eric?
Three.
Cut three. Okay. One, two, three.
Operation Iraqi Freedom.
The showdown with Saddam.
Saddam Hussein and his weapons.
Weapons, weapons,
weapons, weapons.
Are a direct threat to this country.
Saddam Hussein.
Saddam Hussein.
Al-Qaeda.
War on terror.
Saddam Hussein.
Saddam Hussein.
Ridding the world of a bad man.
Saddam Hussein and his weapons.
Weapons,
weapons,
weapons, weapons.
Are a direct threat to this country.
Terror plot.
Saddam Hussein.
Al-Qaeda terrorists.
War on terror.
War on terror.
Next phase, Saddam Hussein.
Absolutely.
We know they have weapons of mass destruction. We know they have active programs.
Leaving Saddam Hussein in possession of weapons of mass destruction for a few more months or years is not an option. Not in a post-September 11th world.
9-11.
9-11.
September 11th.
Leaving Saddam Hussein in possession of weapons of mass destruction for a few more months or years is not an option. Not in the post-September 11th world.
9-11.
Saddam has resumed his efforts to acquire nuclear weapons.
We would be seen as liberators in Iraq.
Do the Iraqi people want the American people to liberate them?
Absolutely.
Weapons of mass destruction. The day of your liberation is near.
We will not allow any terrorist or tyrant to threaten civilization with weapons of mass murder.
Attack on Iraq.
War with Iraq.
Massive bombing.
Do an invasion and just go ahead and do it.
We will not allow any terrorist or tyrant to threaten civilization with weapons of mass murder.
The White House certainly hoping for
war with Iraq.
War on Iraq.
War against Iraq.
War against Iraq.
We cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
Good morning, shock and awe.
Well, more good vibes music from Thus Spoke the Spectacle.
It's a cheerful show, Bill. Cheerful.
Well, we only have 5 minutes left, less than 5 minutes left, and I noticed that we have one caller. Do we want to plunge into the unknown and see what that one caller has to say?
Let's see what they have to say.
Whoops. There you go. Say that again.
Bring them on. Let's hear what they have to say.
Chris Carlson says bring them on. Okay. WBAI, you're on the air. Whoops. Now you should be on the air.
Yes, your cult of bicycling and gardening and getting fresh air and all that, it's all apolitical. It's an escape from politics. BAI, CIA, hands off China and Zimbabwe. Dalai Lama hangs out with Bush. You think that's fine, right? You apologize for imperialism.
You don't listen to a word I say, man. You really don't. Okay, but what do you have to say about this charge, which has been leveled at your...
Yes, well, I don't mind somebody calling it apolitical, because I think that when that charge is made, it usually is coming from somebody who has a fairly narrow definition of what politics is, and it usually has to do with waving protest signs and marching and getting barked at by some really talented organizers. And I'm really against that model. I think the left is dead, and it died for good reason, and... part of what we're about these days is trying to reinvent real social opposition and finding the roots in our everyday lives rather than assuming that we're always going to be protesting about somebody else's predicament. Not to say that we shouldn't offer solidarity to people in other situations, but I think real radical politics starts in our own lives and our own dissatisfactions and reasonable rejection of a stupid life. And,
well, now we actually have two people calling in, which means that by definition, one of them is not the rather annoying individual who just perturbed us. WBAI, you're on the air.
You guys want to smoke weed in the woods and pretend that's politics. You're full of crap.
Well, you listen, you support slave labor in China and pretend it's socialism, so you're full of crap. WBAI, you're on the air.
Love the music. Okay, that last guy was a throwback to the 60s, kind of radical crazy, that is one in a million at BAI. Dude, forget his comments.
Yeah, easily done.
All right.
Thanks.
Anybody else out there? 212-209-2900. We have 1 minute left, so just one call. 212-209-2900. Let's see if this is somebody new. Is this somebody new?
Hi. I just want to comment that small decisions we make in our lives can affect the environment, can affect politics, and I thought many of the points that your guest has made very valid. I mean, there's a ban on plastic bags, I think, in Europe, I think.
And in San Francisco.
And in San Francisco, right. So if we just make small decisions, sometimes, you know, the Chinese have a saying, the journey of 1,000 miles starts with one step.
Yup.
Yeah, thank you.
So it's very difficult, but we must continue the struggle.
My latest metaphor is the tortoise. I like the tortoise and the gangster, actually, not the tortoise and the hare.
Tortoise and the gangster.
Yeah, I think we're the Nowtopians in general have to take the side of the tortoise, or we are tortoises to a great extent. We have to take those steady everyday steps. With, you know, the tortoise as a creature has been on the planet a lot longer than humans have, and figured out how to live pretty well on the planet, and continues to do so even to this day, and has a very long lifespan, et cetera, et cetera. Obviously, in limited areas of the planet at this point, thanks to our activities. But what I like to talk about is radical patience. You know, like those of us that are engaged with this stuff, it's easy to get demoralized. It's easy to give up. It's easy to feel like it's not moving fast enough. It's not. That's true. Guess what? That's how history is. It sometimes leaps forward very quickly, sometimes backwards, sometimes sideways. Doesn't go the pace we want it to. Our lifespans are pretty short compared to history. All we can do is take the steps we can take, and it's not something to feel terrible about. It's something to really enjoy the process of, and that's a big part of what I'm advocating. Radical patience.
Radical patience. Not, despite the fact that your work is entitled Nowtopia and emphasizes things which are happening in the here and now.
Right. Well, it seems totally compatible to me to be emphasizing things that we do, but knowing that they are not the whole revolution in and of themselves.
But
and
it's part of
that
a
they could be
process.
Is overstating the case.
Yes. So, once again, we've been speaking with Chris Carlson, who is the author of Nowtopia, How Pirate Programmers, Outlaw Bicyclists, and Vacant Lot Gardeners Are Inventing the Future Today, with an exclamation point. And this is hot off the press from AK Press out in San Francisco. And it can be got at, you were speaking at Blue Stockings Books here in New York.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.